There were more than 900 fatal opioid overdoses last year in Philadelphia. And now Conrail is being pressured to help rein in a portion of Kensington long considered the epicenter of the city's heroin epidemic. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. That pressure is coming from the city of Philadelphia, and joining me with details is City Managing Director Michael DeBaradinas. Managing Director DeBaradinas, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
So happy to be on.
Often referred to as the Badlands, describe this stretch along the railway tracks in Kensington.
There's about two-thirds of a mile of rail line that's sunken and stretches across the Fairhill neighborhood, which is a haven for drug sales, drug use, and all sorts of illegal activity. And we have been working over the last year to give that neighborhood some room to grow and give that neighborhood a chance to fight its way back. But we found that this rail line is just a serious problem that needs to be remedied if our efforts and the community efforts are going to move forward with some success.
Apparently, talks targeting Conrail began in December. Where are they to date, and what additional steps are being taken now?
We have reached an impasse with Conrail, and particularly around what we think is their obligation to secure that two-thirds of a mile of their rails and their property. Today, the mayor announced that we would begin citing them, both from L&I and Health, for serious violations, with the hope that this would begin a process to get us to a point where we could agree on the cleanup program and could agree on their responsibilities and our willingness to help and support them in that effort. But unfortunately, we're not there now, and we think the citing is an appropriate step right now to move this either conversation forward or move us into more serious and substantial legal action.
What are the nature of some of those violations?
Every 3 weeks, somebody dies on their property. We had 17 deaths there last year. 29 Narcan saves. There is tons of trash. There are makeshift hovels. It's overgrown. It's a weed trees and scrub growth that's just doesn't allow police to see and even go in there and enforce. We estimate there's 500,000 hypodermic needles along that stretch. So there are loads of health violations, loads of building and debris and trash violations there. We're hoping that Conrail will respond and we can begin to clean the property up. But until we get their commitment to secure, clean and secure, we really don't have anywhere else to go.
Be more specific about clean and secure. Are you suggesting, for example, an impenetrable fence?
Yeah, to make sure that if we're going to work with Conrail to clean it up, then once it's done, it will not go back to what it is today. That it'll be cleaned up. There will be no ability to set up open-air drug markets, no place to hide and shoot up, no attraction to out-of-town regional, you know, users and drug peddlers who come there now. So we believe that cleaning and getting good sight lines, cleaning the place out, and then securing it is an essential feature of us to help the neighborhood come back and reclaim not only that space, but the broad definition of their community.
There's a consensus, voiced even by Mayor Kenney, that this has been largely ignored for decades. Has there been a lack of manpower, police power, in regulating the area as well?
You know, many years the city's tried to deal with this, but this is the first time two things have happened. There has been a coordinated effort out of my office, the managing director's office, that can move all the operating departments in unison to respond to service, you know, to housing for the homeless, Narcan for our police and first responders, trash pickup from the streets department. So we can coordinate all of those activities and from the city for the first time. And this is the first time that we've paid attention and have tried to remedy this, you know, the rail line, which is really a cancer in the neighborhood and it needs to be removed.
Comrail has been given 30 days to respond. Discuss the potential of a subsequent timetable if they fail to do so, to the city's satisfaction.
Well, we're early into this right now, so we're going to wait and see how they respond. But we are not afraid to use every power or every legal means within our authority here in the city to move this to a successful conclusion as far as we're concerned.
Mr. DeBaradinas, thanks for joining us again on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Philadelphia Managing Director Mike DeBaradinas on Newsworks Tonight. Conrail released a statement that reads in part, "Until recently, Conrail had engaged in productive, good faith discussions with community organizations in the Fairhoe and West Kensington neighborhoods, as well as the City of Philadelphia, that moved us closer to a community solution. Recently, however, the city has cut off dialogue with Conrail and pursued a more adversarial approach. We continue to work with community organizations on this intractable social issue and, with their support, hope to move toward a more comprehensive solution soon." Lawyers for the Green Party and the Republican Party of Philadelphia are asking a federal judge to throw out the results of a special election in a North Philly state house district last month. They allege voter intimidation and election tampering by Democrats. Details from WHYY's Dave Davies.
It was a strange election in which the only candidate on the ballot in the overwhelmingly Democratic district was a Republican. The initial Democratic candidate was knocked off the ballot, and that left the Democrats waging a write-in campaign for their new candidate, Emilio Vasquez. To make it more complicated, Green Party workers were also asking voters to write in their candidate, Sherry Honkola. It was bound to get hinky.
I've been practicing election law in Philadelphia for, I think it's been 12 years.
Linda Kearns is the Republican Party's lawyer in the case.
What happened that day, I believe, was the worst cases in Philadelphia history. And I think that's saying a lot.
The Democrat Vasquez won by a big margin, but the suit cites about 20 instances in which Democratic street workers and sometimes local election officials allegedly intimidated voters, campaigned within polling places, or committed other election code violations. The complaint doesn't cite names of the offending parties, but Kearns says more detail will emerge in court.
And you're going to hear at our hearing how some voters didn't want to necessarily vote for Emilio or didn't want to necessarily write someone in, and were told things by election board workers, well, that's not going to happen on my machine. On my machine, you're going to vote for Emilio Vasquez.
Election officials won't comment. City Democratic Party Chairman and Congressman Bob Brady says Democrats saw things that looked funny to them on election day, too.
Our committee people and workers have affidavits and documentation that some of the opposition went behind the machines also and were helping voters or whatever, but we didn't have to file anything. We're not sure winners, you know. I mean, it's like 2,000 to 200. I mean, come on.
Vasquez has been sworn in, but the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office and the Election Fraud Task Force of the Philly DA's office are also investigating. I'm Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Two Delaware Republicans walked out of the state Senate chamber in Dover yesterday as two Muslims led lawmakers in their daily opening prayer. Details from WHYY's Mark Eichmann.
State Senators Dave Lawson and Colin Bonini, both Republicans, left the room as two representatives of a Newark mosque read a prayer from the Quran in Arabic and then in English.
Give this assembly the courage that is necessary to lead our state towards a more just and peaceful state.
Senator Lawson called the prayer despicable.
I take great exception to that. I fought for this country not to be damned by someone that comes in here and prays to their God for our demise. I think that's despicable.
Lawson did not explain why he believes they were praying for our demise. Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long immediately apologized to Lawson if there was an offense and did not address those who led the prayer. Later in the session, Senate President Pro Tem David McBride reread the prayer and said he couldn't let Lawson's comments stand.
To criticize the sacred prayer of another religion from the floor of the Senate strikes me as in conflict with everything that we stand for as lawmakers.
The other Republican who walked out, Senator Bonini, spoke after McBride. He said he didn't want to hear the prayer, so he expressed his religious beliefs by leaving the chamber. He said it was unreasonable to expect lawmakers to stand for a Muslim invocation. From the Delaware desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
The Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia has broken two centuries of tradition and put out position statements on climate change, water, evolution, biodiversity, and extinction. WHYY's Irina Zhorov reports the statements come at a time when scientists are engaging more directly in politics.
The Academy has been, by its own estimation, pretty conservative throughout its 200-plus year history. But about a year ago, management decided that it wasn't enough for its researchers to publish academic papers. Roland Wall, the Academy's Senior Director for Environmental Initiatives, says the Academy leadership felt it needed to speak more generally and openly to the public.
Institutionally, we want to make sure we protect our credibility and don't get caught up in something that would be considered too partisan, but I think it's also important that when there is clear scientific evidence and when the science sort of directs us to think we need to do things, that we are willing to say that.
Wall says putting the statements out was a big deal for the Academy, but the statements themselves simply reaffirm scientific consensus on the issues.
I don't think we went out on a limb with anything. We said in terms of climate change, it is occurring. It's a human-caused phenomenon, and we think something needs to be done about it.
Wall adds that public discourse and politics surrounding science have only gotten more contentious since the Academy started developing the statements. A spokesman for the Association of Science Technology Centers, a trade group for science museums and institutions, says statements like the Academy's are a relatively new phenomenon. But he says, at least anecdotally, many of the association's members are actively discussing or drafting statements of their own. Irina Zhorov, WHYY News.
At one time or another, someone at the desk next to you at the workplace may not appear to be exactly his or her usual self. So what to do? Perhaps learn about mental health first aid, a sort of mental health CPR giving employees the tools to deal with distressed colleagues. As part of WHYY's podcast Common Space, producer Elizabeth Perez Luna explored how that program has been applied worldwide since it was created in 2001 in Australia. Let's start by following a mental health first aid workshop in Philadelphia.
I need 10 people to be a disease, and here's what you're going to do. I want you to arrange yourselves.
Today, around 20 people are learning to recognize signs of a coworker in distress. The instructor, Stephen Paisani, is a training and behavioral health specialist at the BH10.
Mental illnesses can be more disabling than physical illnesses. Moderate depression is similar to the impact of multiple sclerosis, all right, or severe asthma or hepatitis B. Severe depression can be comparable to quadriplegia.
The overarching idea behind mental health first aid is not to turn each trainee into a therapist, but to be alert to recognizing when something doesn't seem right with a colleague. After about 8 hours of training, participants go back to their offices equipped with the means to act when needed. The program is growing rapidly, says Dr. Lawrence Real, Chief Medical Officer of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health. He's a strong supporter of the program.
Philadelphia is one of the cities that has really dedicated itself to thinking this is part of our public health approach. I would say by the end of this month or early next month, we'll have trained 20,000 Philadelphians to become mental health first aiders.
The national program, based in Washington, D.C., is directed by Megan Reed. She says companies, large and small, have seen the need to create an in-house resource for people with both temporary and ongoing mental health issues. She really believes that people want to help, but often don't know what to do. It's something that touches her very personally.
When I was 21, my own mom died by suicide, and this is why I do the work that I'm doing now. You know, she was an educated professional, a teacher with a master's degree, who went to work every day, was very active in her community and in her church, and, you know, had become progressively ill over a period of time. And after she passed away, there was a lot of people that said, I knew something was wrong. I just didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to do something, but I wasn't sure what that was, and I didn't want to make it worse. And so we hear those stories every single day.
So the mental health first aid program became her response. But what are some of the misgivings people might have about asking questions or intervening in other people's lives, especially coworkers?
I think that's incumbent on all of us to address the stigma that surrounds mental health and substance use issues in our society, really. And the more people know, the more that they're informed about the common risk factors, for example, of mental health and substance use concerns, the more they're informed that recovery is absolutely possible. The more that they're informed that, you know, 1 in 5 adults in America experience a mental illness in any given year. So that's over 40 million Americans.
So what are the things to do and what are the things not to do? Let's start with the not do at all.
What you wouldn't do is to go up to that person and maybe use stigmatizing language or to judge what they're going through. So for example, I don't understand why you're having a panic attack. You need to control yourself, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get it together. Those are things that you absolutely wouldn't say to a person who is experiencing some sort of potential mental health crisis, for example. The other thing I wouldn't do is, you know, once you've engaged with that person, is to leave them alone without making sure that you've provided appropriate routes for additional support for that person either.
Post-training service have shown that the mental health first aid program is effective for the organizations that decide to send staff for training, and that includes police departments and other branches of law enforcement. So chances are, the next time you ask your coworker, "Are you okay?" you'll know what to do to help. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
A Delaware man recently donated a Victorian book and art collection worth $10 million to the University of Delaware Library. That donor is legally blind, as WHYY's Shirley Min reports.
Born partially sighted, Mark Samuels Lassner can't see out of his left eye. He can see a little out of his right eye with a monocle, but whatever he's looking at has to be within inches of his face.
I have always had trouble seeing, but because I couldn't really excel in sports. I'm, of course, not able to drive a car, do other things. I found that objects, particularly small objects, were very appealing to me because I could bring them close, look at them, and examine them. And of all the objects in the world that I loved most, it was books.
Samuels Lassner's passion for British literature and art from the late 19th century started early. It was almost as if the passion chose him.
I grew up in an 1896 Queen Anne revival summer cottage. When I say summer cottage, it's not really a cottage. It was a 27-room house overlooking Long Island in Connecticut. And so I had, in a sense, a late 19th century childhood.
Growing up, Samuels Lassner met a very close friend of his grandmother's, May Bradshaw Hayes. She was born in London and grew up in the Victorian era.
As a teenager, I would go visit Mrs. Hayes, and she'd tell me stories of meeting Robert Browning as a little girl, of knowing the painter Edward Burne-Jones. So I knew someone who actually had known the people that I became interested in. When I graduated from college, at which point she was in her mid-90s, a box arrived from Mrs. Hayes, which contained 2 hand-painted fireplace tiles that were the wedding gift to her parents from Edward and Georgiana Burne-Jones, and the remnants of a blue and white tea set that were the presents from William and Jane Morris. That's how I started collecting.
Samuels Lassner, who's a senior research fellow at the University of Delaware, says collectors like to control what happens to the items they spent so much time gathering. Now 64, he felt like this was the right time to donate his collection of first edition and signed copies of books and original art, and UD was the right place.
This is the biggest and the most valuable gift that the library has ever received.
Women's Studies and Humanities professor Margaret Stetz curated an accompanying exhibit showcasing the best of from Samuels Lassner's collection of more than 9,500 items.
Charles Dickens is represented here, as well as Charles Darwin and Florence Nightingale and George Eliot.
Like Beethoven, who composed symphonies even though he was deaf, Stetz says Samuels Lassner might not have perfect eyesight, but he sees the big picture.
He has a vision for how to build a collection, how to make things cohere, how to create a kind of narrative so that one item connects with another item. And for that, he doesn't need perfect eyesight. He just needs a perfect vision, a perfect sense of what he wants to build and offer to other people so that they will see what he sees about the 19th century.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Shirley Min, WHYY News.
Victorian Passions, stories from the Mark Samuels Lassner Collection, is on exhibit in the Morris Library on the University of Delaware campus. In a city with plenty of basketball giants, few legends loom larger than Dawn Staley. Over the weekend, Staley led the University of South Carolina to its first ever national championship in women's basketball. The legendary point guard returned to her roots in North Philadelphia today to revel in some hometown love. Details from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
It wasn't quite a parade down Broad Street, but from inside the auditorium at Morrell Dobbins High School, you could hardly tell the difference. Luminaries from across the sports and civic world gathered with hundreds of fans to salute one of their own, Dawn Staley, a kid from the neighborhood who made good.
Everyone that knows me knows where I'm from, knows specifically where I'm from. Because you can say Philadelphia, and it means to me, I'm from North Philly.
Few local sports figures are as beloved as the star point guard turned star coach. Staley grew up in the Raymond Rosen housing projects and turned Dobbins into a basketball powerhouse during the late 1980s. She later became an All-American at the University of Virginia, a three-time Olympic gold medalist, and the head coach at South Carolina. But through it all, she's remained connected to her hometown. After the ceremony ended, she reflected on the meaning of that identity.
These are the people that knew you when you weren't good. Knew you when you were just honing your skills to become good, and they've helped you along the way. And you come back and you're just incredibly proud to know you've made them proud.
And pride was abundant Thursday. South Carolina may have won the game, but the triumph belonged just as much to North Philly. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Philadelphians turned to 311, the city's non-emergency contact center, to find out when trash is collected or how to request services such as a pothole repair or removal of an abandoned car. But you may not know what happens between the time when you call and when the problem is addressed. We're inviting Tim Thornton, the director of Philly 311, to join us on NewsWorks Tonight tomorrow to field your questions about the history and purpose of the department, its range of services, and improvements to customer feedback. You can record your 311 question in advance by calling our comment line at 484-800-1311. That's 484-800-1311. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.